Blog Talk Radio.
Hey folks, it is a show to you online, Entrepreneurship and Globalization. Great to be back here after a hot week in Washington, D.C. We're talking about supply chains of opportunity tonight. So as a transition into that topic, and before I introduce our guest, Greg Van Kirk, co-founder of Community Enterprise Solutions and the micro-consignment model, I want to just say a few words about why this topic is on our syllabus. Supply chains, we all know what global supply chains are. We think about trade, not aid, or the way in which economic opportunity is created by exchange on a global scale. We look at growth in China in particular, but other parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America. To a significant extent, it's been the ability to connect to global markets to sell to and benefit from products and services developed at a global scale, such as mobile phones, that has enabled an increase in global prosperity in the last 20 years. However, we also know that connection to the global economy can create all sorts of disruptions, distortions, and problems of various types. And so when we think about the role of supply chains, clearly it's a complicated topic. So what we're talking about today is the way in which supply chains, global interconnection, and scale and regularization can be used to generate opportunity. The point is not that in every case and under every circumstance, supply chains benefit all of the people up and down the supply chain, whether it be at the resource stage all the way to the consumers or final products. The point is, rather, that if we think about the power of global supply chains, the power of global exchange, the power of regularization, standardization at different stages of the development and the sharing of a product and service, then we've got a powerful tool for entrepreneurship. And this notion of supply chains and connecting to global supply chains is a way that our efforts can both scale, reach more people, obviously, but also scale in the sense of being a model to others. And that's exactly what Greg Van Kirk has done. Greg Van Kirk has prototyped an approach to offering products and services, making them available in remote places, and really bringing people the expanded set of options wherever they happen to live. His work initially was in Guatemala. He'll be telling about it shortly. The set of options that allow people to begin to benefit from exchange on a global scale and begin to do what I refer to as connecting to the global economy in the best kind of a way. So without further ado, let's bring Greg Van Kirk on the line. We've got a bunch of great readings. I think they're great readings, otherwise we wouldn't put them on the syllabus tonight. But one of them is Greg Van Kirk's case. I just tweeted out the link if you didn't have it in your packet earlier. But the case that Greg wrote for Innovations Journal, and it's about the micro-consignment model. Greg is an Ashoka Fellow, in particular, an Ashoka Lemelson Fellow. So this is a distinct group within Ashoka that is fellows that are recognized not just for their social entrepreneurship, but also for a technologically related innovation. He's the co-founder, as I said, of New Development Solutions. This includes Community Enterprise Solutions, Social Entrepreneurship Corps, and NDS Consulting. He has been a participant at the Clinton Global Initiative, was selected among the Ashoka Fellows as one of the elite Ashoka globalizers who helped other social entrepreneurs think about how to adjust or adapt their innovations to broader reach, to really globalize the impact. He has been a consultant globally, and in addition has worked with a number of universities. He's going to be talking to some about how he has connected with students around the world to fuel his initiatives. So now, Greg, are you on the line yet, or are we still waiting to join?
No, I'm here. Thank you, Phil.
Perfect. There you are. Hey, great. Well, great to have you on, Greg, and looking forward to talking to some about the micro-consignment model.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and looking forward to having a good conversation.
Great, yeah. So now we're really about working towards personal plans of action in this course. We've got students from around the world, as you know, from the materials that we sent to you. And so we've been starting out really with, you know, kind of your own story, how you got to be doing the work that you're doing, you know, some allusion to the challenges you may have faced along the way since I know, having worked with you on your case, that it has not always been an easy road, just as it has not been for other Ashoka fellows. So anyway, if you want to start just by telling us a little bit about what you've been up to in your story, that'd be great.
Yeah, no, thank you, Phil, and I'll just try to keep this brief. Yeah, and good evening or good morning to everyone wherever you might be. I started my career, I guess, so to speak, in social entrepreneurship when I was about in 2000, 2001, so, you know, about 10, 11 years ago, when I was 30, 31 years old. And before that, I had actually worked, I had studied business at university, I had done some work in Japan for a few years, and I'd worked in investment banking in structured finance for a boutique firm, and then for UBS for about 5 years. Certainly it wasn't that I didn't start doing what I do in rural economic development because I necessarily became disillusioned with all of those things. I always knew that that I wanted to do this type of work when I was in my 20s and in school, but I couldn't put a finger on what exactly that was. And I knew that I wanted to be able to contribute something and kind of hit the ground running when I did start doing this type of work. And so, as luck would have it, when I was contemplating leaving banking to go and try to figure out how to find my place in this space, I actually read David Bornstein's book, The Price of a Dream, about Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank and microcredit, and that was a real tipping point or inflection point or what have you for this, because I think that was the first place where I really saw how maybe you could apply some type of business acumen to doing this kind of work. So I ended up quitting my job. Good way to find out kind of who's with you. I think when I quit my job in banking, everything was going fine and going well. I think about half of the people thought, you know, that's a great idea. And the other half thought, you're totally crazy. But it was really one of the best decisions I've ever made. And when I quit, the first thing that I knew was that if I was going to work in this field and try to help people in marginalized communities, that I needed to be with them. I needed to understand their needs, their challenges, their wants, their desires. And so I ended up joining the Peace Corps as a way to get out in the field and get experience and really trigger empathy, which I think is critical to all of this work, and obviously is a huge part of what Ashoka does today. And so I ended up going to Guatemala with the Peace Corps, and I lived in a village about 7 hours from the capital. First started out working in microcredit and working with USAID and the local Chamber of Commerce to help them start one of the first rural internet centers in Guatemala. And that was really the foundation, and that's where you know, a lot of struggles, a lot of lessons learned by falling on my face. To keep it brief, I saw an opportunity to create some local jobs Where I was up in the mountains in a town called Nebah, where there were some, I thought there were some tourist opportunities. So I decided to start a restaurant. Certainly from that experience, I learned that you don't need to necessarily know the content. And really sort of a starting point of learning that, you know, the guiding principles for one thing translate to another. You know, best practices are best practices. Fortunately, the restaurant went well, and my deal with the Peace Corps was that I would get it up and started. I'd start it up with some of my own savings that I had. I'd get it to a place where it was financially and administratively self-sustainable, and then I would turn it over to local management and local ownership. And then in addition to that, that I would donate any of the profits that weren't, any of the revenues that weren't reinvested in the business that would have been profits to me in local community projects. So we ended up expanding that and offering a whole host of tourism services, but that was really the trigger for the micro consignment model, because we donated to a wood burning stove project, an improved cook stove project in a village. And I saw just the incredible impact that a cook stove has on a family who's been cooking on the floor their whole life, and really just endeavored to try to create a local business model to help people get stoves. So I wanted to try to develop an entrepreneurial model where we could identify, train, and support local entrepreneurs to go out in villages and sell stoves. And that was really the origin of the development of the micro-consignment model.
Great. Great. So at that point, you have a notion that there's a specific product that could be made more widely available. You know, just to kind of transition into micro consignment, tell us a little bit about Kentucky Fried Chicken and franchising. You know, how does a standard franchise work, and then how does it differ from micro consignment, and then we can get into how you develop the micro consignment model.
So that's a great question. I don't know that anybody's necessarily framed it that way before. It's a great jumping off point. So I think, in a number of ways. I mean, first and foremost, you know, if you look at what we're trying to do, and it can be somewhat nuanced, but it's critically important. And I think mission is always. Is always important in being true to your mission and being very clear in your own head and strategically and tactically what your mission is important. Our mission is not to create local businesses. Our mission is to create access to vital technologies, essential products and services that haven't existed before in marginalized communities. And we do that by empowering local entrepreneurs to create that access for the first time and continuously and sustainably. So, you know, I think one big distinction is the goal isn't to start a franchise. The goal isn't to start a business to make money. The goal is to create access, and it just so happens that the best way to create that access is by empowering local entrepreneurs to go out and solve that access problem over the long term. You know, obviously, there's one big distinction you get within the name is, you know, the micro consignment model, is that, you know, typically in a micro franchise or a franchise type business, it's started with, you know, if you look just from a financial perspective, you're starting it with, say, equity of the owner of the franchisee. You're starting it with a loan, with debt, with some type of financing. Financing is maybe provided by Kentucky Fried Chicken, by the headquarters operation. But if you look at what we do, what we're trying to do is create access to primarily capital goods, durable goods, things that have a positive health, social, economic, environmental impact on people's lives. So these are things that, and to do that for the very first time. So these are things like eyeglasses and solar lamps and water filters and drip irrigation systems, energy-efficient light bulbs. And if you look at all of those things, the only way that they've gotten to these communities in the past is either through donations or not at all. So if you look at then, okay, how are we going to empower an entrepreneur to start a business and go out and sell them, going back to the financial part of it, they don't have money to invest in starting their own business. So that option doesn't exist. Then the option could be, well, what about if we provided credit? What if we provided some type of a loan? Microcredit, as we all know, can work very, very well in the developing world for people who already have a going concern. But these are businesses that nobody's ever had before. You know, people can't evaluate the demand. They don't feel self-confident in their own ability to go out and supply that demand were it to be there. So to ask them to start a business selling what's perceived to be a complicated product that nobody's ever purchased before and nobody's ever sold before with a loan simply doesn't work. And so a big distinction being the financing part is what we do is we go through a whole identification and training process, which is really a self-selection process for the entrepreneurs. And then we offer them the opportunity to go out and do this without having to invest their own money or without having to take out a loan. We simply say, here are the products. We provide them with this basket, this variety of products, teach them how to go out to villages and sell them. Then they sell them, and upon sale, they come back and give the organizations that we've set up the portion of the money that's attributable to the cost of goods sold and to cover marketing and operating expenses, and then they keep the profit. So they realize a profit from the beginning, which spurs them on to continue to do it, helps them to motivate to learn more and to get out to communities and to continue with the operation. So, you know, there are those distinctions, and I just say that, you know, the final point, you know, I think that they're also just from a, if we're going to use, say, Kentucky Fried Chicken as a franchise as a business, you know, some of the attributes of franchise, if you think about why you go to, you know, to a franchise, it's because, well, you know what you're going to get. So you know you're going to get the same thing in every place. In the communities where we work with, oftentimes there isn't much mobility. So some of the attributes, some of the reasons for creating a franchise with the same name, you know, might not necessarily exist. So there are a host of other things, but, you know, the point being is to start at the access problem, work your way backwards, and sometimes a franchise approach will work very well with consumables and healthcare products or Avon Ladies for the Poor. Sometimes microcredit will work very well if there are already businesses in existence, but when we're trying to create new access by empowering new entrepreneurs, we found that a microconsignment approach can be very helpful.
So let me, I think that's really great stuff. Let me try to recap then. So for a small-scale entrepreneur who is, wants, you know, the kind of almost mythical woman who's going to buy a loom or a cow with her Grameen Bank loan, you know, whether or not that was ever a reality of the dominant story, that's sort of the image that exists. But, you know, but that's a known business, and the would-be entrepreneur is able to assess those risks. In that case, a microloan or a Kiva loan, might, which is obviously just another form of microloan, that might make sense. If it's a business that's a little bit more complex, the benefits of having a franchise model, having a manual, again, the Kentucky Fried Chicken, Avon example, known product, but maybe slightly more complex in terms of either the branding or the product itself, then franchise works. But if you're talking about access to unknown products and creating new markets and using micro entrepreneurs as the mechanism for creating that access, then neither micro loans nor a conventional franchise model is likely to be effective. Is that kind of a reasonable way to summarize what you said?
Yeah, no, I think that gets directly to the point. I think it's a great summary. And, I think just as a point, it's, you know, it's borrowing from other models. I mean, there are, you know, all of, be it microcredit, microfranchising, microconsignment, you know, there's certain places where you have overlap and similarities and you take the best practices from one and use the other. You know, if you look at franchising, I mean, we do, you know, the women do have a quote-unquote franchise type look there to the business, and that they do get manuals and they have shirts and they get posters and we set the pricing and do all of these things. But this distinction really just comes down to the financing, which is not just about financing, because it also changes the dynamic of the relationship, right? I mean, if you look at a credit-based franchise model. What you have is, you know, I'm selling you something, I'm maybe giving you a loan so that you can buy it, then you go out and do it, and then you come back and you pay me back and you pay me back the loan and you buy more things, right? But although I would very much like to structure it in an elegant way whereby I know exactly what you're selling and where you're selling and we're getting great feedback, inherently in a credit type transaction, you have a little bit more of an opposite side of the table type relationship. With a consignment mechanism as well, I mean, with a consignment mechanism, what differs in many regards is because you're consigning too, what that means is you create an alignment with the entrepreneur, because that entrepreneur is going out to the village, they're selling things, they're coming back, and you have to meet with them to fulfill their inventory and to divide up the money, which means then you're talking about problems, you're talking about opportunities. So it not only lends itself from a financial perspective, but because it's set up that way, it helps you as well to understand exactly what's being sold, where it's being sold. So it helps you to develop new products. It helps you to learn about what works and what doesn't. It helps you to work with the entrepreneurs so they can identify new things. So it not only helps the initial access situation or access problem, it helps you to overcome that, but it also helps you in an ongoing way problem solve and then learn about what are new things that people might want and need and what are new ideas that entrepreneurs could have that they could bring to the table and you could try to fulfill. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. No, I mean, I think, you know, I know that when we were working on your case, you know, once I sort of got the distinction, it seemed like a really powerful one, and so that's why I want to make sure to underline it, because it really is similar to a franchise model, but different in these really significant ways that I think are worth emphasizing. So now let's go back to where you had, you know, where you are with the cook stoves and the implementation. I mean, you have this beginning of an idea. We're gonna bring on some of your, you know, I'm old enough to remember that old program, This Is Your Life or something like that. Remember that?
This
is your life, and then, you know, it's like come on and have all the people you hadn't seen for decades. Well, these are folks you work with all the time, but we're going to bring on some of your partners who've helped you make this vision a reality. Tell us about, you know, that long process of taking, you know, the concept and basically mobilizing the talent and the people to make this all work.
Yeah. No. Maybe I'll just touch on a few things that, you know, I mean, so when we saw that a bit to my surprise that this model could work with cook stoves, and then, you know, over time realized, okay, it doesn't just work with cook stoves, but it can work with a variety of different things that share similar characteristics, such as the things that I touched on before. You know, then the thought was, okay, well, you know, how are we gonna do more of this? Unfortunately, the needs are, you know, don't number in the thousands. The needs for people to get these types of solutions number in the billions. And so the question is, okay, well, if we've got something that we think can work, can be an important tool in the toolbox of development and social entrepreneurship, how do we scale it up? And an important point, which gets back to I'll keep coming back to chicken, is that, you know, one of the things that distinguishes as well is we're not trying to sell chicken, you know, just like we're not trying to sell glasses or stoves or whatever it might be. We don't have a product that we're trying to sell. We simply have a model that we're trying to learn about and improve upon ourselves and help other people use to get a whole variety of things out there that have a social impact and fit certain characteristics. So as we thought about how to do it, I mean, basically it's been a journey of trying to scale in two ways, and these are all both very highly integrated. You know, one is to scale geographically to create social impact, but also to learn and to make sure that we're not doing something that isn't simply applicable in one region, so to come up with some broad guiding principles, best practices for doing this. And the other is to scale deep, and that's to continue to add on additional options for when a woman entrepreneur goes out to a village. She's not just offering a stove or a pair of glasses, but she's offering more and more things to people. And that
mm-hmm.
has all of its, besides
right.
the social impact, obviously it has all of the economic positive things that come from that for sustainability, for the woman herself, for the people in the field. So in thinking about how do we scale in both of these ways, you know, one of the big things getting into the university partners aspect is, you know, what we realized very quickly is, you know, development work is about people, and you need good, passionate, hardworking people to do this work. You know, we're not airdropping in a bunch of things. We're getting out there, identifying and training and supporting. And so you need a lot of creativity. You need a lot of support. You need a lot of folks who want to get on the ground and do this work. And so realizing that, you know, we weren't going to go out and try to create a massive organization ourselves, nor was that the most practical way to do it, we thought, how can we engage more and more people in a way that's flexible, in a way where everybody wins through this process, and that it isn't burdensome to us from a financial perspective, but conversely is actually something that could help to support our work. And so we started an organization called Social Entrepreneur Corps, a sister organization, CE Solutions, in 2005, I believe. And with that, we work with universities and university students who come down and do internships. Right now we have 170 students, I think, in 5 countries working with us, and work, get up to speed, create, you know, get the foundation for the work and the empathy and the language and all of that and the reasons where we work, and then work side by side with our team out in the field for 8 weeks or 4 weeks or a longer term. So that's been, having Social Entrepreneur Corps as a way to get human capital and financial capital to help us expand our work has been critical. And so we first started with a website that I think myself and my partner built over a weekend. It was just horrific. And we had a few people come on board, and then fortunately, you know, word spread a little bit, and we continue to try to get better and better, improve on what we're doing. And so now we work with about 12 different universities in the U.S. and a new program, a global program, with other universities, and of which, you know, Notre Dame, I think Melissa Paulson might be calling in, has been, you know, they're our very first school, I believe, that we formed a relationship with, and it's just been fantastic. Miami of Ohio, William & Mary, you know, a whole host of different universities, Duke, bit by bit have come on board and really been a part of this effort. And so, you know, as we've been able to scale from Guatemala to Ecuador to Nicaragua to South Africa to the Dominican Republic, and now we're working with an Ashoka Fellow in Peru, and we're starting something in Chiapas, and I'm going to go to Egypt and going to Haiti next week. You know, having Social Entrepreneur Corps and students come in and really join our team for short stints has been just critical, not just for the short term, but now a majority of our employees who work for us full time were students who originally came to us through Social Entrepreneur Corps.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so this is a kind of a second and, you know, distinct innovation, which has been to really formalize the process of involving students in helping to build this out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think on the one hand, it's a separate model unto itself, but I think, yeah, I mean, and you said a bunch of names when you introduced me, like New Development Solutions, and we have Community Enterprise Solutions, and you have Social Entrepreneur Corps, and then we create local social enterprises or empower them. So there's Soluciones Comunitarias, a company in Guatemala that's now owned by 8 Guatemalas that we helped start that's, you know, that's now profitable and continues to grow. You have all these different organizations and all these different stakeholders in the different universities. But at the end of the day, you know, although they may be somewhat separate models tactically unto themselves, the only reason why all of these things fit together well and why they all work gets back to your point about supply chains in many regards. It's that we have a singular focus on, you know, Juan and Juana in the village and their family, and how are we going to get them the things that they need? And everything else serves that purpose. The entrepreneurs, the women entrepreneurs we train, serve that purpose. Our non-for-profit serves that purpose in certain ways. The social enterprises serve that purpose. University students help to serve that purpose. And so the reason why all of these things work well together is because we don't look at them as separate organizations. They have different names and different financial structures simply because that's the way that they need to be and that's how they help to serve this purpose. But at the end of the day, we're all working together as a team focused on the same mission to serve the same beneficiaries.
So, yeah, well, and now we're going to have a chance to bring Brett Smith into the conversation, who has been one of those partners. He's the director of the Institute for Entrepreneurship and the founding director of the Center for Social Entrepreneurship at the Miami University's Farmer School of Business. Brett, you there?
I am.
Great. Yeah, well, thanks for coming in. So you've had a different perspective on Greg's work. You had the opportunity to kind of jump in when he already had something rolling. How did you see this as an opportunity to engage? And I should mention that one of the videos that is assigned for this course is the first follower video. So we've been talking some about how to be an effective social entrepreneur by in some instances joining in on what somebody else has already had going. So.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. And let me sort of lay the context. So from the university perspective, as we see sort of the growth in the field of social entrepreneurship, one of the real challenges is to provide the hands-on, on-the-ground experience. So in many ways, the work actually echoes one of the problems that Greg identified early on, which was his own problem of wanting to go and do Peace Corps before he tried to do this work so that he would have something to contribute. So for us, part of the reason to partner together with Greg and his wonderful organization was our students were getting coursework, they were getting co-curricular opportunities. What they weren't getting was on-the-ground field experience. And so Social Entrepreneur Corps provided that opportunity for us and a number of other universities to really give our students that hands-on, on-the-ground opportunity to touch and feel with and play with and understand. When we say, oh, it's difficult to do a last-mile solution, that's one thing in a classroom in the United States. That's quite a different thing on the ground in Nevada. And so on the one hand, for us, it was a really important student experiential opportunity. Now, that has continued to grow and develop. So for us, it has also become a very important key strategic partnership where we do academic research. So we've partnered with Greg and his organization on a number of academic research kinds of projects, including a field-based experimentation. And so it's really important. I look at it as a way to sort of move the whole field forward, is that Greg's organization has provided an opportunity for universities and social entrepreneurs to come together and partner and sort of try and, lift all boats, if you will.
So, so how do you, when you talk about the impact on your students of having this type of an experience, what kind of, changes have you seen in terms of the opportunities that they've seen for themselves? Do you see them kind of then inspired to kind of go on and try something similar?
Yeah, so I think it's a great point, Phil. So if we look at what has happened to the students that have either learned about the model or experienced it firsthand, your sort of first follower example is a wonderful one, because many of those students have then taken that and tried to see, are there opportunities to, rather than reinvent the wheel, implement the model? So we did a program with U.S. Department of State and now have students that are experimenting with this model in Morocco and Egypt. We have some of our own students who went and spent time on the ground and then have gone out and worked with other organizations like Partners in Health, again, thinking about how does this model lend itself to other places, other interventions, other medical technologies, if you will. And so it's really been a wonderful example. As Greg points out, it's a model. And so it's a distribution channel, if you will, but the products and services that you attach to it, the geographies that you implement it, in some ways are limitless.
Now, so let me start to bring in some questions from Twitter for both of you. One of them is from CJ, and it kind of speaks to my experience a while back teaching in D.C. public schools when, you know, I came to the conclusion that it's not so much that being a teacher is the thing that helps society, it's being a good teacher. And the teachers who are less able are doing less of a service. In this case, you know, when you're talking about having students coming in, being involved in training, you have really kind of unproven, well, I mean, by definition, these are new entrepreneurs you bring into your system on the micro-entrepreneur side. So you've got both the model implementer and the micropreneur, as Ayn Khan's putting it, as fresh talent. How do you get them up to speed so that they're really making an economic and social contribution?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and if I could say overall, I think that on the one hand, I think that, you know, students or people are thinking about getting into this field undersell themselves in terms of what they have to offer. But on the other hand, I would say structure, and which gets to this question, is extremely important. So, if you look at, again, what we're trying to do and create that access, yeah, then the question is, okay, how can a student over a certain period of time help us? Well, one of the very, you know, the very important first parts is we have a foundation building segment, so to speak, where they live with homestay families that normally don't speak anything other than the local language, where they take intensive Spanish classes, let's say, in a Spanish-speaking country, where, you know, they have, you know, visits with other organizations that do other things to get different perspectives. And then, you know, this, say, for an eight-week program, this is then when we teach. So if in the morning you're studying Spanish for 4 hours, the next 4 hours in the afternoon, we're giving essentially a course on aid strategies, on critical assessments of different types of models. I mean, what we want people to do is to be able to get, you know, the content, the context, so that then they can think critically and help us get out there and change things and create and improve on things. So, you know, starting with globally.
This is all in the country before they go out to be model implementers.
Yeah, this is, so they'll be in the country with our team doing, say, 2 weeks of this foundation building.
Got it.
And this is where they'll be, you know, they're learning about logic model frameworks, learning about social entrepreneurship from a practitioner's perspective in many regards, you know, the do's and don'ts, what works, what doesn't, best practices and dynamic discussions, and then getting up to speed on the technical things that we do. And then I think, you know, so it's important that you have that foundation. Just dropping in and starting doesn't work. You need to get the foundation. You need to have structure. And then, secondarily, if you think about, well, what do they do in the field? And anybody sort of listening, I guess, as a student, thinking about, well, can I do this? Well, you know, there are basically, we break it down into five things. You know, one is needs analysis. So we want to figure out what's the right solar solution or what's the problem around rainwater harvesting. Well, it's to go out and observe and to ask questions. And to be in meetings with people, and to take in what they're learning, and to think about and to present to us, they work very much as consultants, what are the needs? Not the real needs, but what are the perceived needs of people? Because the real needs are one thing, but what do people really perceive as their needs and as possible solutions are critically important. The second thing they work on is helping us to design feasibility studies and pilot projects. So if we understand the needs, how can we get out and test some things? I mean, one of the attributes of the model is, it's very easy to layer a few things on, get them out to a village and try them out because entrepreneurs are already going out there. So can we try some things out and learn from that? You know, the third thing is entrepreneurial support. A majority of the women that we support have a primary school education and have never been entrepreneurs in the past. We actually don't call them entrepreneurs in Spanish. We call them community advisors. So, you know, when they're out at a campaign in a village, customer service, financial literacy, helping to, helping to manage clients, helping with marketing and advertising, all these things that we take for granted, but that actually, even if you don't come from a business background, you have a pretty good perspective on. And then impact and evaluation, sit down with the family that has a stove and ask them questions, not just so that we can understand the social impact, but if we understand why they're buying something or why not or what they like or what they don't, that helps us to do a better job of serving other people in the future. And then finally is expansion. And that's when we go to a new region, a new country, like the Dominican Republic right now, for example, once the students learn about our model, then they go out to other organizations that we might want to collaborate with and do an introduction and talk to them, or they help us out with training new entrepreneurs. So there are a whole host of things that folks can help us out with. And much more for us, it's about how to prioritize the right things. But the critical thing is to understand, yeah, you're not going to make, you know, everybody wants sort of a relief work impact. You want to be able to go and build a house very quickly and say, I did it. It's not necessarily that, but each one of those stages and each one of those things is critical to us achieving success over the short and the long term. And were it not for students, we wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are today.
So, I mean, that's certainly seems like, a way to get a sense of both the possibilities as somebody who's outside that, you know, you feel like with two weeks of foundational work, students can go in there and make a real difference. But then without those 2 weeks, the impact and the possible contribution is diminished because some basic context is needed. I wanted to take one more question from Twitter, and then we're going to go to a couple of the calls because we've been neglecting our callers the last couple of weeks. But to both of you, I guess again, particularly to Greg, Brett, you're at a university, so you're working with students. But you know, we've got our audience here for Ashoka U Online is mostly folks who aren't enrolled in formal degree programs. How can, you know, is there any way for people not enrolled in universities to be a part of this? Particularly our international students, our students all over the world, I should say, we're all kind of international, but who are, who already have that context, who may be able to use their own kind of background in where they live to be implementers. I mean, is there any structure set up to provide a window for them to be part of this?
That's a great question. Just a couple of quick points. I mean, certainly, to the extent that somebody wants to come in and work with us, you know, via Social Entrepreneur Corps, if there's another creative idea that somebody has, it doesn't matter to me if they're a student or not necessarily. We're just looking for good people who have an open heart and an open mind and want to get out there and get their hands dirty and do the work. Apart from that, if you think about going back to the scaling part, there are basically three ways that we see is scaling. You know, number one is doing it ourselves, as we've been doing in these countries, but that's not the way to really reach the kind of scale that we hope to achieve. You know, that's going to take a million years if we do it all ourselves, and nor is it the best way to do it. The second part is working with strategic partners. So that can be other Ashoka Fellows, other NGOs in different parts of the world where we don't have a presence and where we admittedly might be totally ignorant as to the local cultural norms or societally how things work. So if anybody's working with a local organization that simply shares the same types of beneficiaries and the same type of mission, we'd love to work with them to support them through this. And then the third part is disseminating knowledge. And that's, writing and creating media, which we're in the middle of doing this right now, which Brett and I have been working on a lot, so that other people can just sort of take it and run with it, and adapt it for their own local circumstances. So, overall in those last two, we're still, unfortunately, just because of the whole, there are only 24 hours in the day, but we're still, we're still in the process of creating that media and that text and to do so in a simple and easily accessible manner so that people can have it. We've been working with Brett to create this Center for Micro Consignment at Miami University. But our whole goal is to be able to empower others who want to take this as a tool and use it in their own environments and their own circumstances to create access for folks in other parts of the world.
Brett, I'm interested in your thoughts on this as well. Last week we had our new president at George Mason University, Dr. Angel Cabrera, talking about how universities need to adapt to remain relevant and even potentially to have greater impact in the 21st century. You've been doing a lot of really interesting work around just that question. What have you seen as being kind of the function of the Center for the Micro Consignment Center at Miami University, and how do you see the university in particular as a good place to do this work? I think it's a relevant question because although many of our students aren't in university settings, a number are, and I certainly am. So really interested in that question myself.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific question, and it's one that right now we're in that moment, right? We're in that moment where universities are trying to assess and sort out what knowledge creation and dissemination looks like, over the next couple of decades. I think in the social entrepreneurship space in particular, there's just a tremendous need to allow as much dissemination of knowledge as we can. So I certainly applaud the work that you and Ashoka Yu is doing in this type of a platform to allow a much broader dissemination of knowledge, and it's very consistent with the work at the Center for Micro Consignment. So our view is that we want to provide any level of possibility that the user wants. If the user simply wants to read about micro consignment and take it and run with it, that possibility will be there for them. If the user wants to take it and actually experience it firsthand, that will be there with them and sort of anywhere along that continuum so that they could get knowledge, they can get hands-on experience, they can get online, they can get on the ground, and let really the user be the decider, the decision maker in terms of how they get access to that information. And so the push behind the Center for Micro Consignment is to scale the micro consignment model. But to really do that, the foundation of that is the knowledge platform that allows that to go out there and be disseminated through lots of different channels.
Well, I mean, and that's all encouraging to me because as the editor of a journal, I'm also always concerned about how traditional forms of knowledge dissemination, like just writing up a story and throwing it out there, can still be of value and of use. But you're talking about an entire spectrum of activities that allow folks to kind of engage with this this approach, either in just kind of a by analogy or else really to work directly with Greg.
Yeah, no, that's completely right.
Yeah, so I wanted to close by spending a few minutes, not necessarily talking so much about micro consignment model or what we're doing at Mason or you guys at Miami University, but more the analogy part. I think that one of the reasons I like this topic, and I really, I think that what the work that you guys have been doing and the micro consignment model is so important, is that it's one way out of this sort of trap of limited impact or this profusion of models and of or particularly of initiatives, each of which is really well intended, but in the aggregate they just don't reach enough people. And Greg, you talked about strategic partnerships. What kind of approaches have you seen in other organizations where social entrepreneurs have formed strategic partnerships with organizations that already have well-established operations, whether they're logistics operations, whether they're even research and knowledge dissemination activity, whatever it happens to be, and have used this combination of, you really emphasize structure in the training and the importance of this kind of regularization. So combining regularization with partnerships to great effect. Can you give us some other examples that you think could help motivate, you know, all the folks here at Ashoka U Online to come up with their own ideas?
Take it from a little bit of a different approach, if there are, maybe that'll help me think of examples, but a little bit better. But I think, you know, this point about scaling and partnering, I think is a very important one. And I think that, you know, one of the things for anybody who's listening, getting into, the field now, a very, very interesting time to be in the field with all of the thoughts on scaling and you know, apart from the thoughts on measuring social impact and social enterprise and impact investing and all that. But, you know, I think, you know, scaling, what we've learned and what I've seen is that just like, you know, it's the thing that makes social entrepreneurship be what it is in many regards is because it's counterintuitive, right? So if you look at, go back to the Muhammad Yunus example, I'm going to give loans to poor people and they're going to pay back more than wealthier people do. That doesn't make any sense. It's extremely counterintuitive. You know, so I think so much of what we do is counterintuitive. So I think when you're engaging with partners, you have to take into account that there is that counterintuitiveness, that there is maybe a little bit of skepticism to begin with. And so simply engaging with partners because of what they do, that they look like they might be a good partner. I don't know that works so well, taking that approach. I mean, what we found is that, you know, the most important things are, you know, maybe sound a little bit, Pollyanna or what have you, but are really critical in that, it's about trust. And can you find a partner where you can build up trust? I mean, that's why working with others, say Ashoka Fellows or people within your own space, within your own circle, so to speak, is really, really helpful because you already have that trust to begin with, right? Because you're trying new things. You're going to fail. You're going to fall on your face. You know, somebody's going to get something wrong. You need the trust as the foundation. I think the other part is certainly with that trust is having the same core values, the same guiding principles, because strategy and tactics might change over time. They should change over time, right? But what's going to keep you on the same path together? What's going to keep you walking down the road together? It's that you have the trust, you share the same core values, you share the same guiding principles. So those things, I think, are foundational, and those are the things that you have to work really hard at to begin with to try to work out. And if you have that, you know, then I think you're kind of 80% there. And what we found is if you look at what kind of people to work with, you know, on the one hand, you know, if you're a social entrepreneur such as ourselves and you have a model, you know, the initial thought is, well, let me go out and find some really big organization that can embed my model and do this. And I think that's what a lot of social entrepreneurs try to do. But a really big organization already has its own bureaucracies for better or for worse built in. You know, they've already been doing something for a long time. They already have their own ways. They might not be the best organizations necessarily to try something new and layer it on top. You know, on the other hand, you want an entrepreneurial organization. But entrepreneurial organizations are oftentimes small, and they don't have much in terms of resources. So you have to find that balancing act between those two things. We've really tried to do, and I think that big challenge is to find the partners who share those things and find the balance and understand that there isn't a one-size-fits-all. But if you have those, you share the same beneficiaries, you have buy-in from the leadership, and the incentive systems for the people actually doing the work, the staff, the team, are properly aligned, you know, then that's where you can have success regardless of, you know, necessarily, you know, what the strategy and tactics are of the organization.
I think that's a great answer. And it was, you know, sort of, different than what I was thinking, but I think what you're saying in some sense is the relationship is more important than the scale, a priori, or anything else that might be involved. So a little bit following from that, we got 5 minutes left, and I think that gives us enough time for each of you guys to tell a kind of a you know, one recollection, one story of kind of what happens when things click into place. Our co-instructor Aaron Krampitz tweeted this to me. I think it's a great way to close. You know, so Brett, maybe you first. You know, sort of some instance where it really came together, and you know, from whatever your objectives are, what you stated as your objectives, and then Greg, same for you. So Brett, you want to start out?
Sure. So let me take it this way. I think helping to ground both our students and for that case our academic experience in the field was one of my first ahas. So Greg and I spent time together, and we were in Tecton, and I'm talking about all the benefits of microcredit and microfinance and how it works, and Greg's sort of nodding along with me. And then we get to this Village Square, and he says, okay, microcredit creates access, right? I said, right. And then we look around, and on this street corner, there are literally six different microcredit organizations, one with a van and a loudspeaker saying, effectively, free money. And so it immediately grounded the experience to help me understand what microcredit sounds like from a distance and sometimes how it plays out on the ground. Of course, not all the time. There's lots of great things. But often it's the implementation of the model that you see. So I think part of our work with Greg has allowed both our academics and our students to truly ground their experiences in real, on-the-ground sort of opportunities, both for good and for bad, to understand the challenges of what it's like to work in rainy season and to understand the benefits of what it's like when that first person turns on a solar lamp, plugs in a solar lamp for the first, or gets electricity in their house for the first time. And so those have been tremendous ahas. And one final thing on the partnering part, one of the things that we've been very fortunate to work with Greg on is it's always been about, let's make sure it's sort of the classic win-win, but the first thing we ever asked was, what's in it for you and what's in it for us? And the credit doesn't have to be shared equally. It's just, you can't have losers. You can't have it be negative to one partner or the other. And so we've continued to iterate time and again, but always make sure that everyone's staying whole and that there is equal benefit that's being recognized by all of the members. And so, as I said, our experience with Greg has been terrific, starting with very early grounding and continuing to iterate to this day.
Yeah. You know, I think just looking at from the field perspective, and you know the work on the whole, you know, it's interesting. I think you know, there's obviously a real benefit of having you know 10 years of retrospective and all the different phases you go through during that. You know, from trying to figure out what you're doing, you're always trying to figure out what you're doing. Don't get me wrong, but to then thinking you have something, and then to knowing that you have to get out and promote it so that people understand what it is and buy into it. And, you know, and then I think certainly then taking a step back and looking at what is it that we really do and having it all in perspective and looking around and seeing what other, you know, some other just really incredible people and incredible organizations are doing around the world. And you know, this is where I come back to, you know, the microconsignment model is a tool. It's a tool in the toolbox. It's not the end-all, be-all. It's not better than this, better than that. It's simply in this situation for these things. It seems to work best. But even more so, you know, importantly, sort of with the, I don't know, the humility of the tool to a certain extent, it's also just realizing, you know, what it is that you do. And I think the most important thing that we do, or anybody does ideally in this work, is that that tool simply provides an opportunity for someone. And, you know, things like empowerment, and so that people can have control over their own lives. But even more so, and I spoke about this at the Ashokiyo Exchange a while back, but, you know, more and more just comes home to seeing somebody who didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel before, to see that they now see one. And that they now have a sense of purpose, And they have a reason to get up and to do something. And to not, you know, we talk about economic models. You know, it's you know, people work for three reasons, right? It's to put money on the, it's to put food on the table, it's to contribute to your community, and it's to self-actualize, right? To reach your potential, to be who you can be. And I think sometimes we lose focus when we talk about economic models because we talk about the money aspect so much. But I think people, you know, probably 99% of people on this call, you know, really do what they do or want to find what they do for the other two reasons. And so to see people who, because they're able to now have an opportunity, can go out and feel a sense of purpose for their own lives and self-actualize, so to speak, and get out and feel a sense of purpose in helping their community, and that we simply offered sort of a trigger in that process, that is something that is just fantastic to see. And yeah. And that's where you see people, you know, go forth and do all of these amazing things that, that they never thought possible themselves. So I think that's the greatest contribution we can make.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a great, that is a great way to close, Greg, on the topic of supply chains of opportunity. And I think it underscores, you know, I think a theme throughout this, this course for me and certainly from what we've heard from our students is that when we're talking about opportunity, we're certainly not just talking about economic opportunity. We're talking about opportunity to do both those other things you mentioned, contribute to community and really self-actualize, really do something that's meaningful and purposeful in the world. So, and it seems as though you have done just that. Okay, so we're done. All right, thanks a lot. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on, both you guys, and we look forward to seeing you sometime soon down the road at some Ashoka event or maybe working with you someplace out where micro consignment model is active.
Thank you, Phil, for everything, and thank you very much, Brett, and it's a pleasure to be on the call, and I hope everybody has a good evening. So thank you.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Bye.
Good to see you.